Okay, well, first of all, Happy New Year and welcome to the January 2024 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for current DMSC students, alumni, faculty, and those interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. This allows us to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession, as well as those in healthcare who have made a difference. And today's guest fits that bill very much so. A few housekeeping issues for all of our attendees. Please keep your microphones on mute. Please make comments in the chat session if you have any comments during the presentation. And once we are finished, we'll open up to questions and you can unmute yourself. Dr. Beth Popray, our administrative manager of the DMSC program, will monitor the chat for any questions or comments. So I've been looking forward to this evening for a long time. And let me take a minute to introduce our guest today. Dr. Alfred M. Sadler, Jr., MD, FACP, also known as Fred, first learned about the PA profession at the National Institutes of Health and Duke University back in 1968, which means he knew Dr. Eugene Stead, the father of the PA profession, very well. And since then, he's been actively involved in so many aspects of the PA profession and continues to be a strong advocate. Let me just mention some notable milestones of his career. In 72 and 73, Fred helped establish the what was called the Association of Physician Assistant Programs, APAP, it's now PAEA, and served as its first president. He played a crucial role in developing accreditation standards for PA programs in collaboration with the American Medical Association and the Association of American Medical Colleges. In 1973, he played a key role in launching the first certifying examination for PAs by the National Board of Medical Examiners. Also, together with Dr. Tom Pym, he co-founded the National Commission on the Certification of PAs in 1974. And secured foundation support to establish a national executive office in Washington, D.C., both for APAP and for the American Academy of PAs. Dr. Sadler graduated from Amherst College, Amherst, Massachusetts, in 1962, and the Drexel University College of Medicine in Philadelphia. He joined the U.S. Public Health Service at the National Institutes of Health in 1967 after completing a surgical internship at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. During his time there, he focused on analyzing medical legal issues related to transplantation, clinical research, and the licensure and certification of allied health personnel alongside his twin brother, Blair, who is a attorney. In 1981, Fred transitioned from academic medicine to private practice on the Monterey Peninsula in California. I was just thinking how fun that would be to be there right now. Over the next 35 years, he practiced general internal medicine, established a health center for underserved populations with the assistance of a PA, served as the medical director of a retirement community in Carmel Valley, directed an urgent care center in Salinas with PAs on his staff, directed the employee and occupational health department of Salinas Valley Memorial Hospital, and mentored PA and nurse practitioner students, both from Stanford and San Jose State Universities. In 2017, he co-founded the PA program at California State University, Monterey Bay, and served as their associate medical director. He also remains active in the fields of bioethics and organ transplantation, while regularly speaking at PA commencements and white coat ceremonies and teaching PA history at various programs. Fred has authored several books on the PA profession and healthcare. In 1971, he co-authored the White Paper on Physicians' Assistants, Looking at the Future, with his brother Blair and associate Ann A. Bliss. This paper, prepared at the request of five foundations, later became the book The Physician's Assistant, Today and Tomorrow, which is the first book on PAs. And I remember that book very well because I was looking at PA school when that book was published. It addressed significant policy issues and emphasized the importance of interdependence among healthcare professionals. He's also co-author of The Physician Assistant, An Illustrated History, 2013, written in collaboration with Dr. Tom Pym. Reginald Carter and Ruth Baldwig, and supported by grants from the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. In 2022, Dr. Statler co-wrote the book, Pluck, Lessons Learned from Improving Healthcare and the World, with his brother, Blair Statler. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But I could go on and on. That's just a small part of what Fred has done in his life, both in healthcare and supporting the PA profession with extensive experience and contributions. But I'd rather hear from him first. You know, Dr. Statler, welcome to the masterclass.
It's great to be with you. I have had friends besides you who I've known forever. For a long time, it's nice to see Bert get on the. Hello, Bert, and hello everybody else who's may have gotten on recently. Great to be with you.
Great. Well, let's get right to it. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we talk about your contributions to the PA profession, you know, you and I have talked a lot over the years. But talk a little bit about how you decided as medicine being your life's work. I mean, how did you end up in medicine?
Yeah, thank you for that. I had a marvelous experience, if you can say, having excruciating middle ear infection at age 6, be a marvelous experience. But both Blair and I in our third floor attic apartment that we lived in as part of the growing up together in Pennsylvania had, not surprisingly, the same infection. Probably simple otitis media. And this wonderful pediatrician came to our house and he had his black bag and it was about, 8 o'clock at night on a Friday night. And he made a house call and he sat next to me and examined me. But his voice was so soothing. His manner was so supportive and compassionate. And then he went over and did the same with Blair and then talked to my mother at the head of the stairs and said, "Now, Mrs. Statler, if you have any other questions." And, he took, I think, out a long glass tube of an antibiotic that must have been tetracycline. This is 1946, 46, 47. So, and some Tylenol, I'm sure, So, call me if you have any problems there. I'll come out tomorrow. And so then that just kind of receded. Then now fast forward to sophomore year in college, and a bunch of us are sitting around with bull sessions at this men's school that I went to and thinking, what are we going to do next? And I wasn't sure. My dad was a brilliant PhD organic chemist, and I did research and was doing research in Pennsylvania. I was not a lab rat guy at all. That I was much more of a person. So I wasn't thinking about following in his footsteps particularly. But after a couple of these discussions, I came back on this experience I just told you about, and I remembered how great it felt to have Dr. John Fromm, the pediatrician, come to the house. And I thought, if I could do that for someone else in medicine, that sounds like something I'd like to do. I think that would be, there's a real heart-to-heart connection. So it was very much an emotional dimension to my choice. And that's how I got into medicine, which I think may well be, you may have parallel stories in your own careers about why you got, in this case, PAs, but is that rare chance to work with a sick person and to comfort someone, which is, as we all know, is so important and is as important as being a good diagnostician or everything else.
Yeah, wow, that's a great story. And that was long before even Dr. Welby was on TV. So what a great story. Well, Fred, we talked a little bit a minute ago about your book, The Physician's Assistant, Today and Tomorrow. It was a groundbreaking publication in the 1970s. As I said, it was one of the first books that I read about the profession. How did that come about?
Well, You mentioned that Blair and I worked together. Blair, my twin brother, 4 minutes younger. I'm the elder, and he went to law school. We were in Philadelphia together. We got to know each other's professors, and we thought, it might be fun to work together. And we gave a few talks on the Good Samaritan problem, which seemed to go well. The whole idea being that we're, of course, taught to stop at the scene of an accident or to help someone, going back to the Bible. But the lawyers, on the other hand, let's say there's not a good outcome. The patient doesn't do well. They or the family might look at this a little differently. So that was the basis of that talk. And from that, we looked at other areas where medicine and law could overlap, from use of human beings in research, organ transplantation, definition of death. Even back then, they were talking about genetic cloning, and they were doing brain frontal lobotomies. And is that an ethical thing to do? So we wrote up this 10-page paper. And figured, now where can we go? Well, we're 66, 65, 66 now, and Medicare, Medicaid had just been passed. And that is important in the story of why PAs and NPs, because we all of a sudden had this great extra need for personnel to take care of all these newly enfranchised older people and poor people. But we weren't sure where we could take this. And if you do read Pluck, which is about the 9 years we worked together and the four areas that we'll talk about that a little later, that we worked on, one of which was the workforce issues. We looked around for a way to get into the public health service if that was possible, since there were some lab rat kind of colleagues who were applying to work in somebody's lab, like Anthony Fauci or someone like that in the Heart Institute. And you could spend your 2 years in, it's a uniformed service, but it's not a military service. And NIH, of course, is in Bethesda, and CDC is in Atlanta, and then they have the Indian Health Service. That's the public health service. So we began to look into that. And then here's where the Pluck comes in. The title of the book that we came up with, we were told when we were writing this up, that you gotta have to have a catchy title. And so we had all these boring things like The Power of We and Collaboration. And there'd only been about 25 books written with titles similar. But in the course of a discussion with an editor, we came up with Pluck, which means courage, chutzpah, willing to take a risk. And the last four letters of Pluck are luck. And it's amazing if we reach out and take a chance, as you all have done in your careers, I'm sure, and multiple times, how many other people, how lucky we get. In the terms of the people we meet and the support we get and all of that. So that's where Pluck comes in. But getting back to your question, we went on to Yale from NIH. Well, first at NIH, just real quickly, we were asked after we did a lot of work on organ donation and transplantation, which is a couple of chapters in the book. And we're involved in writing the model law that allows us to donate an organ and the next of kin to make a donation if we haven't. And these are all state laws. So you have to write a model law that then gets adopted, which it did in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. So that was a very exciting adventure to be part of. And we realized we could make a difference, even though we were 26 at the time and 27, and weren't sure whether anyone would listen to young whippersnappers who, had no weren't a professor like Professor Danielson or something, So we're asked to look into the legal issues and the credentialing issues of these new experimental practitioners, PAs at Duke, NPs, and then eventually CHAs at Colorado, and MedX at Seattle. So we got to go to all the programs, meet these people. We were both so impressed, but particularly me being in medicine, with the enthusiasm of the professors and the PAs themselves, many of whom were military corpsmen coming back from Vietnam with this phenomenal amount of experience, but no real place to use it except as an orderly. So we wrote up this 100-page paper for the Assistant Secretary of Health about the various alternatives of credentialing, and came up with a team at Duke, Harvey Estes and Martha Ballinger, are names you probably know. We did so much. And we came up with the idea of just amending the Medical Practice Act, which defines what a doctor can do: operate, diagnose, treat, and prescribe, are the four magic physician words that only a physician can do. But there's nothing in the paragraph we added that would prevent a physician from delegating to a specially trained assistant or nurse practitioner. I guess I just said nurse. Those tasks for which that person was specially trained, as long as it was in the scope of practice of the physician, and both were responsible. So that was agreed upon. We didn't have time to take it through the commissioners on uniform state laws that we'd worked with for transplantation, which is about a 3-year process, because students were coming out the door, and Gene Stead and Harvey Estes at Duke were saying, we got to figure out a way to license these people. And there just happened to be a moratorium on licensure. That's a whole nother story that I've written up, in a bunch of places. So this worked. The Federation of State Medical Boards that supervises and organizes all the various state medical boards said, well, as long as that it's under a physician supervision and control. So that passed in about 33 states very quickly. And then on eventually, and was kind of the law in the 70s. So then we went on to Yale, and the way that happened was that Jack Cole, this marvelous physician surgeon at Drexel, had been at Western Reserve originally, went on to Yale, and I'd heard that. And I, as one of my other jobs besides working with Blair on medical legal things, was to run a kidney and urology program in the Arthritis Institute. So I made a site visit to Yale to should we renew this grant, and I just used a little pluck and, thought, I'll just see if Dr. Cole is in and if he remembers me and stuff. So I went to see him, and he not only remembered me, but he had our New England Journal article that we just published on his desk. And I thought, as the Japanese and my Japanese wife would say, that's an auspicious sign, So then when he came in, and it was a real love in because he did remember me, and I was so happy to see him. And then he talked about what his plans were for the Yale Department of Surgery that he just inherited about 6 months before, and one of which was to address the woeful state of emergency medicine at that time. Some of you are old enough to remember, before there were EMTs and ambulances were just station wagons, and the docs and nurses in the ERs were not specially trained in emergency medicine. They just often retired into those jobs. So we took said, so anyway, Jack said, I think you and Blair would be perfect to run this trauma program. And so once again, and we'll get to this in the principles that we talk about in the book, we were complete rookies. We didn't know anything special about emergency medicine, So as Gladwell talks about in The Tipping Point, you have to become a maven in your field, even if you go from rookie to maven. So we did that. And we're just thrilled at the opportunity because it allowed us to continue our work. And then we told him, we really want to start our own PA program here. And that's why we were the sixth program in 1970, 71 to start with five students. And then Dr. Stead gave the first commencement address in January of 73. So we did emergency medicine on the one hand, PAs on the other. Jack Cole was a consultant to five foundations in New York who met over common interests, and they'd all supported some of the early experiments in PAs and nurse practitioners. And they were wondering, what next? Is this an idea that was really worked out well because there were brilliant leaders, as we all know? And Loretta Ford, by the way, from Colorado, she just turned 103 in December 28th. And my wife Eddie and I have gotten to know her quite well and talked to her on the phone. Eddie's painted her portrait. My wife's a nurse practitioner who's now into art full time and is quite the artist. So she was just delightful. And it's quite remarkable to be 103 years old and spry, living in Orlando, Florida now. Unfortunately, her husband died maybe 10 years ago, but she was a great nursing leader. There were some nursing leaders that were a little pro nursing and anti-medicine, as we all know. But then there were others like her that were, willing to work collaboratively. So the foundation people said to Dr. Cole, we really would like somebody to write a paper for us, a white paper, which is a name for a position paper, essentially, on a subject. Is this idea of they back then they called them people mid-level practitioners. I know that will all make you break out in a rash, but are these people going to be able to make a difference in Michigan and in Arizona and Pennsylvania and other places where there's not a Jean Stead or a Loretta Ford? And what's the legal issues and what are the nursing issues? So we brought in Ann Bliss. So Jack Cole came back and said, "Yeah, would you guys like to write this paper?" And we would said, "Of course." So we were able to build on our previous work, and that's what we did. They loved the paper. It set sort of the template of how non-physicians would fit into the system, not just at Duke or Colorado, where you had, a hothouse plant supported by a star. And they said, we don't want this paper just to sit on our shelves, although it's very helpful to us, but we want to turn it into a book if you're willing to do that. And we went to Yale Press, turned it around, and by 1972, it was the physician assistant Today and Tomorrow, which they then sent out. Having written this latest book, and I know a lot about trying to market your own book, very, very different. Like it's all on your own money, unless you're Oprah Winfrey or something. And so they said, "We'll send this out free to whoever you think should get this." So every US senator, every US congressman, every dean of every medical school, nursing school, school of public health, all throughout the government, state governments, got this book in the mail that with a little clip that said, "Sent to you for the courtesy of the five foundations." And then we used it at the first meeting on new health practitioners in May of 73, that was sponsored jointly by AAPA and the newly formed APAP, that all of them got. There were 250 attendees. It's one of the most exciting events in the PA firmament that I've been lucky enough to be part of. So that's the story, and I'm sticking to
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
it.
I wish we had hours and hours, but to talk more about your time with APAP and NCCPA, and also with the PA History Society. But let's jump right to the book. I got a copy of it a number of months ago. It's wonderful, 10 chapters, with just packed full. If you're interested in being a clinician, a leader, a human being, this is the book to review. And I think it's got a huge, when I talk to my medical writing students, I always tell them the importance of the title, and this is it. You know what, for sure. Talk a little bit more about putting that book together, and then I'd like to sort of get into some of the things you talk about in chapter 10 that we can give as advice to our attendees today.
And I'd certainly welcome any questions and answers too. So we want to, so I'll make it really brief. But so over the years, so Blair and I went on to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation after Yale, and that was an interesting chapter. And we used our model of regional emergency medicine in Connecticut. Connecticut was sort of our social laboratory of 35 hospitals and 179 ambulance companies, and started EMT training in 1972. The Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons had developed this marvelous program they've been working on for 3 or 4 years, and that just happened. There was a case of luck out of pluck. You know, one day there was this orange book. It's still called the Orange Book in its 13th edition by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, that at 81 hours to be an EMT, you know, the basic resuscitation and all of that. And then, of course, there were no paramedics, and that's a whole nother pr wonderful profession that happened. But we had this chance to go to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and join their senior staff, which we then did. And that was very exciting. And our model of EMS was used in 44 other places around the country of regionalization. And my job was to get more primary focus on primary care physicians and to find places where PAs and NPs could be worked together, which led to the 1974 grant to Stanford and to Davis, which were the two that had PAs and NPs for a long time. So moving ahead, I came to the point where this into my 9th year of not seeing a patient, but having so much fun and being so lucky to have all these opportunities. And it was a time by, it was a real can-do time. Some of you who are old enough to remember, there were a lot of us that were out there doing things. There's Office of Economic Opportunity. The Kennedy presidency was very exciting, and before he got shot, and then all of the work in getting voting rights passed, and Martin Luther King, and the worst part was the Richard Nixon shenanigans from 71 to 73. But as long as we kept being focused on doing our work, which is what I'm trying to do now, that's kind of how I get through each day, given our even crazier political world that we're in. I don't know how you do that. But that's what I try to do, is keep my head down and do something. Over the years, so I decided to go back, and it was the big fork in the road. Do I go back and finish my training? Because I just had an internship, and I clearly would need to do another internship because it'd just been too long. So I decided to do that, and by that time, I had drunk the primary care Kool-Aid. And went to Mass General Hospital in Boston, and did another internship and residency in internal medicine. There's a track of 4 of the 20 of us who had an interest in primary care. So from day one, we had our own panel of patients that we followed for 3 years, and we got more outpatient psychiatry, GYN, ENT, dermatology, then. Yeah, our colleagues in straight internal medicine were doing, who were going on to subspecialties mostly. So then I looked around. I got a professorship out at UCLA. Blair had moved out to San Diego to, he wanted to stay in health, and he got a job first at Scripps and then running Children's Hospital of San Diego for 26 years. And meanwhile, I got this professorship at UCLA to start a geriatric program in the Department of Medicine. And again, I was a rookie. I didn't know a whole lot about geriatrics other than what you learn in internal medicine. But clearly, that was a field that was emerging, and I was used to doing that, you know. But the pr only problem personally was that I wasn't having much time to see patients. I really didn't have a panel of my own. I was writing grants and supervising fellows. And so I had to make another decision. Do I stay in academics, which I was now 40 years old, or do we plunge into medicine? And I was very fortunate to hear about an opportunity in Monterey, California that I'd never been to, because it wasn't a big enough center to visit from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation compared to UCLA or UCSF. I got here, and I've never seen a more beautiful place to live in this country. I mean, there are a lot of them. We're blessed, but and the internists were great, and the hospital's great. And so been a Californian for 43 years. Still not a golfer. I'm a rackets guy, tennis and squash, but there's a lot of golf out here, as you know. But it's just been a fascinating place with a lot of interesting people. Our big underserved area is the Hispanic growing community that John Steinbeck writes about in East of Eden so brilliantly. And 110 years later, frankly, things haven't changed. There's kind of the side where I live in Carmel, where there are people with all kinds of interesting backgrounds, and have most of them have money. And then there's the Salinas side up in Santa Cruz toward Watsonville, where it's mostly Hispanic, mostly growers. So I, after 10 years, decided I really wanted to do more for the underserved and learned Spanish pretty well with the use of cassette tapes that then became CDs, which then became and listened to the basics and ran this urgent care, which was open every day of the year, 365 days of the year for 13 hours a day. And we had a wonderful mixture of physicians with different backgrounds, internal medicine, urgent care, emergency medicine, and a PA or two, and a nurse practitioner or two, and worked with the hospital in Salinas, which in this case was Salinas Valley Memorial. So that's my story. And then, meanwhile, people, when they talk to me about, where did you come from? Well, I was born in a little town called New York, I went to these schools back east you probably never heard of. But anyway, then I tell them a little more about, like I've told, been talking to you, and Randy's been going over with me. So what else did you do? And people say, geez, you did all that in 9 years. And that must have been really interesting. You ought to write a book. I must have heard 100 people say, you ought to write a book. Well, I was kind of busy, So if, finally, at age 80 or 78, I'm 80, about to be 83 in March. Blair and I got around to writing a book, and fortunately, with the modern technology of being able to send drafts back and get instantaneous result, and we always worked together and wrote together because we wrote a book on emergency medicine as well, and a whole bunch of articles and stuff. So we were always good collaborators that way. And that's how I came about to getting into it. And it was a good exercise. People have said, did you ever argue with your brother? Don't twins always argue with each other? And as you'll see if you read the book, about we had decided early as teenagers when we were on the tennis court that why don't we just collaborate and not compete and keep score and just hit the ball and help each other. And we figured that out, was that we were both a lot happier than one guy being ticked off because he lost, and the other guy was ticked off that he was ticked off that, So we did have a few disagreements, but not around the kinds of things that a lot of co-authors do around how you word something or something. It all just worked out. So it's just been really a fun exercise, and I'm so glad we did it. It's written, there's about five dimensions to it. It's historical, obviously, about these four areas. And chapter 9 brings them all up to date. And what's amazing about medical ethics, transplantation, emergency medicine, and workforce is all of these areas have exploded over the last 50 years. Medical ethics, for example, they're just a, where it was an occasional person interested in research on human beings, and say particularly if they were volunteers, and there were some bad things like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment that's so infamous. But now every medical school, every graduate school, every PA school, there's medical ethics is a big part of it. And that's one of the fields some of our PAs have gone into, as well as the docs. And you just look at our daily life, the medical ethics that every US citizen is dealing with, to mask or not to mask, to mandate or not to mandate, to mandate a vaccination or not a vaccination. How much should be with polio? When I was growing up, everybody got vaccinated. Now, I don't remember ever hearing, of course, my parents were very educated, so they didn't even think of questioning this when Salk came out in 54 with an injectable, and then Sabin it was 65, 55. Of course you did. You got all these inoculations, and there have been more of them for more diseases, of course, as more have been developed. But now there's this tremendous split within our country, which is it saddens me very, very much. But my point simply is medical ethics is something all of us should be thinking about, not just us that are fortunate enough to be educated, but every US citizen, every parent, needs to think this through. And let's face it, a lot of them aren't, and the same is true. Transplantation has grown to more organs, to more with we have more immunosuppressive drugs now, starting with cyclosporine in 84, and now just more and better, better. And who would have thought that we would have 306 accredited PA programs? I in a million years wouldn't have thought that. I thought once we got over the hump, I think a lot of us did, of getting this new group of Medicare recipients and Medicaid recipients taken care of, we'd have everything covered. But we found out, I think, in part because PAs have performed so magnificently, and nurse practitioners have too, that people, our patients, and I'm sure you've all had this experience, just love to see you. They're Randy Danielson's patient, or almost more than the physician's patient in many cases.
Yeah, wow. One of the things that I liked about reading your book was just what you talked about, the history and the four major areas, and in particular, when you get to chapter 10, based on all this experience you've had in these four areas, you have some advice. There it is. You have some advice, and talk a little bit about why chapter 10, and then I have a couple of questions. Some of the things you talked about in there. I do want to leave some time for some of our attendees to ask you questions as well, but talk a little bit about chapter 10.
Thank you, Randy. So, as we were working through this process, we would come to an end of a chapter on, say, the organ transplant law. And there were some clear lessons that we learned. And we'd say, maybe a good way to end the chapter would be to throw in a lesson or two. Well, we kept finding they overlap. It was a so we find, let's have a separate chapter on lessons. So we have this chapter called Lessons Learned, that 15 lessons for catalyzing change. And we quote Congressman John Lewis, who died in 2020. And he said, when you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. And it brings me to tears. It's just so, and it goes on about how we have to do something about democracy. And that's the feeling. What the lessons basically say is, well, the first one is start where you are. And we quote Candy Leitner, who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving when her 13-year-old daughter was killed, by a drunk driver. And she's going through her grief, but she says, I've got to do something. She didn't know anything about any of this, but she took it on, you know, and then she developed this whole organization. Arthur Ashe, when he went to play in the tennis tournament in South Africa, said, "Oh, what's the big deal about a black person playing?" And he said, "I'm a black tennis player. I'm not a black politician. My contribution, you know, is to play, be the first black person to play in the South African tennis tournament." So that's our point. Simply, you don't have to be an expert. Start where you are. Then we grow from beginner to expert. Find and develop your voice. We think that's so important, whether it's in writing or in public speaking. And I myself got very involved in Toastmasters. I told Randy about this and how much it helped me in my presentation skills. It's just practice like everything else. And most of us don't have any formal training in public speaking. So that we find very important. Find partners is another one. Foster collaboration as opposed to competition. Lead from any chair. You don't have to be the professor. You can be a brand new fellow. And like the fellow in Australia who figured it out that Campylobacter pylori that could live in a pH of 2 and was the cause of ulcer disease. And you didn't have to cut out half the stomach of these patients, which I was brought up with. And he was laughed out of the GI meeting when he presented it. And then 2 years later, he's getting the Nobel Prize. But, you know, is that extraordinary or what as a fellow? And sometimes persistence is the only option. Invite all stakeholders. When solving a complex problem, the simplest is often the best, sort of the Occam's razor. And that was what we did, for example, in the story I told you about having a simple amendment to the Medical Practice Act. Now, over the years, that's evolved, but that allowed PAs to practice in 33 states within you know, 5 years. Seek out mentors, we think, is very important. We were lucky enough to have several that I mentioned several. Keep your eyes open, an opportunity will often appear. When your path is blocked, change course. And we quote Shirley Chisholm, the first Black congresswoman, for that's her. We steal a lot of quotes from a lot of people, Emily Dickinson. And, you know, when solving a complex problem, the simplest is often the best. I got to that. Act with transparency and build trust. If I wouldn't you all agree that if you have a leadership that you can trust and that listens to you, you're going to be part of a team. If you're competing against each other all the time, it's probably not going to work or completely fall apart. Take the road less traveled, which we certainly did, and it's borrowed from Robert Frost, and then finally dwell in possibility. And we talk about each one with something that related to the book, but also something outside the book. And then we have a chapter on kind of what we've been doing the last 35 years when we went our separate ways. And,
Wow.
but it's written for the general reader. It's not a scientific tome. It's supposed to be inspirational that if we could do this stuff at age 26, 7, 8, 30, you know, you can do it. And then we talk about Gladwell a lot, and his be a ma you can be a maven or a connector or a salesperson once it comes to making change, or you can be all three, as we often were. And then our other favorite word, and then I'll close, is interdependence, as opposed to independence or dependence. And Stephen Covey actually opens his book on the 7 habits of highly successful people. He has a front page that has one word on it, one sentence on it. Interdependence is more important than independence. And because we're all interdependent with each other, you know, and not just the big three professions that we think about, but our medical assistants, our front office people, our, you know, subspecialists that we work with. So.
Wow, that's wonderful. And thank you. I wish we could spend, like I said, hours and hours. But I do have, there are a few more questions I have for you. You've given us some great advice over the last, I don't know, 45 minutes or so. And as you know, at AT Still in our DMSC program, we've got PAs from a very diverse group of PAs, diversity in location, all over the country. We even have one student in Germany right now. We have, I think, what, Beth, probably about 150 graduates, maybe I'm
Oh my gosh,
some.
we have like 210 graduates.
Yeah, but who's counting? Yeah, 210 grads who are out there, making a difference. And we've got wonderful stories about what they're doing, and our faculty are from all over the country as well. I see Jim Delaney here, who's one of our graduates and one of our faculty. So, what's your advice, to this diverse group of doctorally trained PAs for the future?
Well, I would pick up on, not that I have anything to say that's original at all, but what I would say is it picks up on the 15 lessons in the book, and not to mention that there aren't others, but I see kind of forward. See, you guys are real experts at this too, so you see what if I hit the mark with this. I think there are kind of four areas that advanced PAs can go off into. One, if they're a star clinician, they can take, in some cases, the extra certification. In some cases, it's just more experience. But the advantage of getting a doctorate where you focus on, say, emergency medicine or psychiatry or whatever it is, and how to teach and be a better preceptor. So there's the clinical dimension. That's one. Second would be education. If you really want to be a PA educator, let's face it, you can't learn it all in PA school, and you can't even learn it on the job unless you're very unusually talented. But if you can spend a year or two in the kind of program you have and learn about the ways in which people learn and the different styles, and that's one. A third one would be to be an advocate. We need people who are passionate about getting our profession, the PA profession. And I can say our profession because Tom Pym and I were the first two honorary PAs in 1974. So I'm really proud of that. So I consider myself a PA as well, even if it's an honorary PA. I think learning to how to present with state legislatures, medical boards, PA boards, work with nursing, work with and this for me, the corporate practice of medicine is not one of the happiest things that's happened. Let's see, the fourth one, besides those. Somebody help me out here. What's the fourth area that you could go to be? Oh, in research. Let's say you're just taken by the new surgical technique or the new diagnostic technique. Some of these, well, or AI. I mean, let's face it. So there are all kinds of areas. You don't have to be a physician or PhD to do research, but go that route, and maybe that might even take you away from direct patient care and into the lab.
And one of the things that we're seeing PAs move into now is medical science liaison with pharmaceutical companies. A lot of PAs moving into that, and having that doctoral degree really helps them with that. So, I think you've listed some wonderful things. As we sort of get ready to land this airplane, I'm going to open it up to some questions, but I have one last question, Fred. What do you do for fun?
This is a lot of fun. Talking to my brothers and sisters in the PA world is one of the most fun things I get to do. But I've been a rat in terms of athletics. I picked up tennis in high school and got quite good at that. Blair and I were both tennis pros for 5 summers in graduate school, undergraduate and graduate school. And then I've stayed with that. I've had both my knees operated on. They're both successful, so I'm back on the tennis court, and there are no squash courts right around here because then that's the game we learned at Amherst, which is a indoor racket game that some of you may know. So did a lot of that. There's no question that I really need Al-Anon in the sense that I or CODA, codependency. I clearly have worked more than I should have. I think I went 5 years at one point without a vacation, a real vacation, when I was here in practice and doing all these things, because I had trouble saying no when there's something to do. Fred, could you help out with this? And pretty soon I'm ahead of it, or I'm spending 5 hours a week on it. In addition, is that so? Eddie and I love to cruise, so we've probably done about seven cruises. We had a cute story where we were going to try and get married on a cruise ship, and then found out that they didn't have a wedding chapel after all. And so when we went on a cruise a year ago, we renewed our vows on January 1st of last year, and it was just, tears of joy all around.
That is great. Thank you so much. Let me open it up now to any of the folks here that might have any questions or comments. You've gotten certainly some accolades in the chat area. But Beth, do we have anybody
So,
or?
yeah, we do. Yeah, Justin posted, would Dr. Sadler be willing to share his thoughts on PA independent practice? Does he see does he think this might damage the relationship with the physician?
That's such a, an important question, and I really don't have the crystal ball to answer where this might be in 20 or 30 years. But I was very disappointed when AAPA, what, 6 years ago now, decided to separate more and more, and get rid of supervision and just go to collaboration without sitting down and with the AMA or the Academy of Family Practice and Internal Medicine and hammering this out together, but just doing it. And then that immediately causes pushback. So I would say, whatever we decide, and I'm wearing my PA hat now, as opposed to my internal medicine hat. Let's do it together. Let's sit around the table together and negotiate it together. And it may take a little longer, but it saves fights. And I'm very much against the independent nurse practitioner just charging right ahead. I think the thing that we still have, that is, that the nurse practitioners don't, is I think there's re some real confusion about what's the practice of nursing and the practice of medicine, and can you get a DNP, which if you spell it out as a doctor of nursing practice, can you practice medicine under that? Certainly when Blair and I did the review of the law in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a clear distinction. If you looked at the Nursing Practice Act, it was about assessing and evaluating. There was no diagnosing, treating, operating, prescribing. So they kind of slid in the back door. And I think that's not the way to do it. But that's so I would just say, to the extent that we can collaborate, then I think it's interesting in some states like California, only f I think it's still and hasn't been changed that an individual practice can only be owned by a physician. So 50 or 51% and 49% PA kind of thing. Other states like in Maine, PAs owned and operated their own emergency systems and hired physicians. And so it was all flipped around and it all worked out great. And Jim Cassidy from the second Yale class, I just happened to see because we had our 50th reunion after a couple of delays with COVID in October. So I did that's it's a little wishy-washy of an answer, but I believe so much in collaboration, and I think we need to do this in our politics in general, right? I mean, let's not have our first reaction be they're wrong because they're Republican or they're wrong because they're Democrat.
Yeah, that's great. Jim Delaney has his hand up.
Thank you, Randy, and thank you, Dr. Sadler. On that, when we talk about independence, I think that's sort of, if we go back and you mentioned a little bit about the Clinton administration, and I'm going to bring up the Balanced Budget Act 1997, and the Balanced Budget Act sort of gave the PAs and NPs the ability to be reimbursed by Medicare and to be recognized by Medicare, but the NPs were awarded, were privileged in the fact that they were not required to have any linkage to physician oversight. And as I remember with that Balanced Budget Act, the purpose of that was is because there were a lot of nurse, and I don't think they were called nurse practitioners either, but advanced practice nurses who were in rural communities who were on the ground doing things with people on dialysis and all sorts of things. And it was a way for them to be incentivized to be remain in those areas where physicians or other healthcare providers weren't. So at least there was somebody providing care. So going to that question where that was just asked about independence. Right now, Medicare, the federal government, no longer requires physician oversight for PAs anymore. So in a way, it's parity. And so what the nurse practitioners do, in my view, is they took that term independent because they were 1099 employees. And perhaps I think we're confusing, I think many PAs confuse independent is to be independent. And I like your statement to be interdependent. We are interdependent. Healthcare is, and I think the big fight is about teams and team leaders and that sort of thing. But I guess where I'm going is, would you think the physician community support a PA independent, as like nurse practitioners are doing in the 26 or 27 states now, if they primarily focused on the underserved in the rural communities where we can't get healthcare providers?
I think that's a great point, and certainly some of our outstanding PAs. We pick out a few heroes in Pluck, and one of them, in terms of our PAs, is practicing down in Texas near the border by herself, and we talk about how what a contribution that is. She's still tied to a physician practice, but it's 50 miles away. And so in many, many ways, she is practicing independently. And certainly when I was working in the urgent care center that I ran for so many years, Steve Panettone was the PA's name. He was so good that he didn't report to me to about each patient or the doctor. We were so confident with him, and he had a kind of a subspecialty in orthopedics, so he knew all the different named signs about knee examination that we didn't, for example. And he got a 99% in his PANRAY exam every time. So he was doing a lot of independent work in as part of our group. So I think you make an excellent point, and maybe it's just good that some of us really old timers who grew up with this is the way, we're going to allow for the first time, whether it's Buddy Treadwell or Vivian Thomas at Hopkins and these amazing groundbreakers. But they're very much tied to a specific physician. We could have a whole ha an hour discussion on this point, so I'll just leave it alone and say I think all your points are excellent.
Great. Anybody else, Beth? Anybody else want to have a question or?
Chris, did you have a question?
Or a criticism, if you're going to have. I must have. If not, there's one other quick thing I'd like to say. If I and that is, I really enjoyed my time and the Physician History Society, which I got on board with in 2009, after it had been turned over by Reggie Carter from Duke to AAPA, and then AAPA had that big financial meltdown that we all remember when Bill Lineweber was the exec. And so he basically said, sorry, we can't support you. So we looked around, and there is, it's something I've never really written up, but Bill Marquardt was the president, and he and Mary Warner was very involved because she was with the NCCPA. To make a long story short, that's when we moved it to the NCCPA as a, we were, became a 501c3 under them. And Randy was, coincidentally, it's one of the times I saw you, were you were president of the NCCPA Foundation that was it's focused on oral health and done so many wonderful things. So that's when the 2 years or 3 years that where the whole History Society was struggling, will it go under or not? And we were able to, with Janet Lathrop was the exec at the time, and was very supportive.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like Greg, you have your hand up.
Well, for those of you who know me, you know I always like to make people laugh and tell funny stories. So I have a good Fred funny story. You know, I've known Fred for a million years, but I had never met Blair. And when you talk about identical twins, these are identical twins. And by happenstance, Fred was just talking about the PA History Society. I was doing work with NCCPA. I happened to be in the offices in Atlanta. And I had a conversation with Fred. And, you know, an hour later, or longer, because how long it takes to get to the airport, I'm sitting on a flight, and I hear a voice that I'm thinking, boy, that voice sounds familiar. And I turn, and in the aisle seat, I'm in an aisle, and the aisle seat one behind me is Fred Sadler. And I thought, well, that can't be. I just left him. But it wasn't Fred Sadler. It was Blair Sadler. And I'm telling you. So I said, you must be Blair, because this is impossible that you look identical and sound identical and all that. So I always think that's an amusing story.
Oh, that's great. All right.
Great.
Any other questions or comments? We'll wind this up, but we can have another question or two if we need any.
And don't hesitate to send me something by email. Randy will circulate my email. Yeah.
I'll do that. Well, wonderful. Thank you, Fred. I can't tell you how thankful we are for your time today. It's just wonderful to hear about your life and all the things, and looking forward to the next thing that you're going to say yes to. So, but thank you.
Great to see old friends and new friends, and congratulations on the great work that you guys have been doing all these years.
Thank you. Okay, everybody. So, hey, please mark your calendar for our next masterclass. It's February 19th at 4 p.m. Arizona time. Our guest will be Dr. Maha Lund, a longtime PA educator who's currently dean of Elon University's School of Health Sciences in North Carolina. Her story will inspire you as well. So please join us. And again, Happy New Year. And thank you all for your time tonight. Be well.
See you guys. Have a good